Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Compound and Friends. This show is sponsored by our friends at Grayscale. Don't know where to begin in crypto? Start with Grayscale. More on Grayscale in just a moment. Tonight's show is an all-new edition of What Are Your Thoughts? It's myself. It's Michael Batnick. We're going to start out with the recent events in the Middle East and the market impact as a result of this weekend's conflagration. We'll look at oil prices, energy stock prices, and everything you need to know about how the markets are digesting the most recent round of attacks, bombings, etc. Then we're going to go into congressional stock trading. Look, if you're like most Americans, you absolutely love and support this. I think we can all agree there's absolutely nothing wrong with the people who sit in Congress and legislate and debate laws and make policy, also benefiting from that very activity that taxpayers are paying them to do with their brokerage accounts. Like what could possibly be more American than that? I don't know. So we fully support it, and we've got some new data on how politicians were trading the events of Liberation Day. We're going to look at market-wide sentiment. We're going to do a whole thing on NVIDIA, OpenAI, Microsoft. You're going to have a lot of fun. So without any further ado, I'll send you right into the show. Guys, make it happen.
Welcome to The Compound and Friends. All opinions expressed by Josh Brown, Michael Batnick, and their castmates are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Ritholtz Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of Ritholtz Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Alright, gangsters, it's time for an all-new edition of What Are Your Thoughts? I am your host, Mr. Downtown Josh Brown. With me, as always, my co-host, Michael Batnick. Michael, say hello to the people.
What's up, people? Josh, how are you? It's good to see you.
I'm doing okay, dude. I'm honestly having one of the best weeks of my life. I have to be very honest with you. I'm just happy.
I love it. If you're happy, I'm happy.
Thank you. I really think this Florida thing has legs for me. I think this is where I belong. All I do when I'm down here is like eat healthy because my wife only eats healthy. Like I'm eating more vegetables on a daily basis than probably ever in New York. Walking all day long, and
you look slender,
dude. Lifting weights, walking in the pool, and working. And like that's it. Like there's no commuting, there's no schlepping. The weather is incredible. Everyone I meet is like, I used to work in finance. I'm like a celebrity here. Like everyone's like into financial shit. Like it's amazing. I really don't want to leave.
It was nice knowing you.
I know. I have a flight in 2 hours, and I'm seriously considering missing it. Okay, today's show is brought to everyone by our friends at Grayscale. Curious about investing in crypto and not sure where to start? Start with Grayscale.
Grayscale is the world's largest crypto native asset manager and has been in crypto since 2013. That's a long time when you consider how early we still are in crypto adoption. Grayscale also offers the widest selection of crypto investment products in the US, over 30 different funds for investors to choose from. That's plenty of choice for both first-time crypto investors or crypto experts.
You may not be considering crypto for your portfolio today, but whenever you're ready, Grayscale can be your guide. When you think crypto, invest Grayscale.
Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. For more information, visit grayscale.com.
All right, grayscale.com. Thank you so much, guys. Hey, if there's any such thing as a guaranteed buy signal for stocks, it's probably when the guys who sell options trading newsletters start going on TV talking about the Strait of Hormuz. I'm just going to tell you straight up, like anytime it gets to that point where like the traders are like talking about any kind of geopolitics, but when they go to this Did you know that the Strait of Hormuz is responsible for 30% of all of the oil the world uses each day? Like, it's this thing where you ever meet somebody who just read a book and then every conversation is like about that book? Remember when Chris read, or I should say, listened to the audiobook of Robert Moses?
Oh, and then 3 years.
Oh, my God. It was like 4 years of... Oh, that's just like this time when Robert Moses.
Dude, those were the dark ages. Those were some of the worst years of my life.
So this is like, and he didn't even read it. He listened to it. Shout out to Chris, but oh my God, don't tell me about a book you listened to. All right, so wait a minute. So this is one of those things like in the last couple of days, he's got, and I know these guys. These are guys that like, I used to work on the Chicago Board of Trade or whatever. And I was like a pit guy. And then I transitioned to like, trading my prop account, and now I sell a newsletter. Okay, no disrespect. That's cool. Why the f*** are you talking about the Strait of Hormuz with a straight face on TV? What are you, geopolitical expert now? Well, if you think about how economically sensitive the Strait of Hormuz... I said, not the Strait of Hormuz! Now what are we going to do? The minute that starts, just it doesn't even matter what you buy. Just pick 5 stocks, buy them. 4 of them will be higher within 48 hours.
All right.
That is an automatic for me.
Generally a good rule, but not when the VIX is at 20.
The Strait of Hormuz.
Are you mad? There's nothing going on in the markets. There's no volatility based off this event.
It's just, can we? So I have CNBC on in my place, and I'm like, not like watching, it's just on because it's always on. But every host of every show brings up the Strait of Hormuz. Is that like in the rule books? So the minute Israel defends itself against any kind of action, you know, any kind of action by Iran, it's like, well, we have to mention the Strait of Hormuz during every hour just to remind people that that's the biggest risk. Is it the biggest risk? I don't know.
Let me ask you a question. Am I in the minority? Here's what's on my TV all day, every day.
Let me see. Nothing. Yeah, that's weird.
Is it weird? I think it might be weird. There's never anything on. I mean,
you just raw dog the day?
All day. I never have TV on. Like once in a while.
You don't want a ticker, like just if there's breaking news or anything?
I don't know. I think I'm probably in the minority. I never have the TV on.
Oh, one thing though, I turned off all my breaking news alerts on all my apps. Like nothing is breaking in my life anymore. Maybe that's why I need there'd be something on the screen.
Here's what I have on my other screen all day, every day, never leaves the screen, is the stock tickers. So if there's anything going on, I'll turn the TV on if I have to.
Okay. I think it's just background for me to just glance.
Yeah, I think it's normal to have the TV on. I think it's normal to have it on. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very strange that you can get through a whole day that way.
I might try it.
Strange but impressive. What's your take on the way the oil market, I was going to say reacted.
I'm so happy you would ask.
I said failed to react.
As a former energy analyst, no, literally, I know nothing. I know nothing. So I was talking, here's what I know, nothing. But I was talking about this with Ben today, just how it's interesting how little reaction there was in the market, even in the crude market. And there was obviously, was it Sunday night? Crude futures were up 8%, not nothing. 2 days later, gave it all back. And the production, import-export dynamics of our country today versus the past look radically different. So yeah, it used to be a lot more impactful. The energy companies were not 3% of the S&P 500. They were 12 and 13% back when we were very dependent on foreign imports of oil. And in the market view, it is not a giant story compared to what it used to be.
That's the point. I actually was going to say 20 years ago, if this were 2005 and Iran had fired hundreds of missiles into Israel and then Israel retaliated to the extent that it did, and they now effectively control the skies above Tehran, which is a really interesting story that I know nothing about. I'm just going to tell you, you would have seen a massive reaction in the S&P 500. And you would have seen names like Exxon, Chevron, and all of the other follow-on energy stocks up 10, 12, 15%. Like there'd be no doubt about it. And I don't know if that speaks to the massive increases in domestic oil and gas production here in the United States, to your point, or if the public, the markets at large have just contented themselves with this idea that oil price volatility is just a perennial, like this happens, something happens every year that either disrupts or potentially disrupts the supply of crude around the world. And it never seems to be the thing that wrecks S&P earnings. And therefore, these market-wide reactions are just going to be short-lived. Let's do a chart.
Yeah, go ahead.
So 3-year WTI crude price, nothing. Like literally not. That little squiggle at the very end, that little spike, I mean, again, compared to 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, it's almost as though nothing happened at all.
Yeah.
Now, of course, Iranian oil is not particularly important to anyone other than China. There are sanctions. There are reasons why that's – but it's still part of the global supply. And if you're buying oil from Iran, you need to buy it from somebody else if for whatever reason that gets disrupted. One of the things that the non-market news sources are talking about is that Israel is very deliberately not going after export terminals, not bombing the types of assets that would ordinarily cause the type of price spike that we're talking about.
All right, and that seems like a big part of the story.
Yeah, it might be in cooperation with the United States. Might be a conversation between Trump and Netanyahu. Look, you can mostly do what you want, but don't cause massive inflation as a result of whatever you're doing. So that's probably part of it. Next chart is I own this ETF. This is just my shorthand for domestic U.S.-based producer exploration and production companies, oil and gas companies. ConocoPhillips is like a third of this ETF, by the way, COP. But IEO is effectively flat over 3 years. It's done effectively nothing. This is my oil price. This is my oil spike hedge. This is like a permanent part of my portfolio where if something really drastically spikes the price of oil to the point where the whole market sells off, this is like the way that I'm hedging that risk. And it acts like a hedge. It's up 5.5% in total return over 3 years.
Are you taking
that's
the hedge
effectively,
off?
It's effectively down.
Do you take the hedge off when it works?
Never. Never take the hedge off and actually add to it as the rest of my portfolio grows that so that it's still an oil shock hedge commensurate with what the size of my overall portfolio is. The problem is I'm always a net buyer if I'm trying to keep it somewhat constant as a hedge because look at these stocks versus like anything I own that's software as a service or AI related. It's like a joke.
Yeah.
But you don't know if you're going to need it till you need it. Here's the XLE. I own Chevron, which is the second largest component of this, but I don't own this ETF. The XLE is the S&P 500 energy sector spider. We don't use the term spider anymore.
I say spider.
You do?
You okay, spider?
It's just the ETF spider. So
I thought you said you did own XLE.
I thought you
spider.
Said you yeah. No. You said you said you were long.
I didn't say I was long, you son of a bitch.
Come here, you son of a prick.
Long. Yeah.
Dance the drink over to me. All right.
Shout out to Spider.
XLE up 8% in total return over 3 years. Horrendous.
Wow, impressive.
You'd be outperforming this with a checking account. I don't know what I do. You actually need World War III for these stocks to go up. So energy is the cheapest sector in the S&P 500 now, significantly cheaper than utilities, which are supposed to be the cheapest sector. There's just nothing happening here. And I don't know what it takes for this to be a leading sector. It doesn't look like it's going to happen this year. We've got multiple wars going on that concern oil and gas supplies globally, and nobody gives a shit. Nobody's worried about scarcity. And I think the market-wide story is also interesting. Put this chart up. NASDAQ, S&P, Dow. Are you surprised at how quickly we completely erased the threat of World War III? Looks like it took about 12 hours.
I am. Given the nature of the V-shaped recovery that we just experienced, you would think that the bears could take a little bit back. And you can make the argument that the momentum has stalled over the past week or so, right? Like, we are maybe forming a short-term top here, but the fact that they can't even punch through, they can't even make like a lower high. It's kind of, it is interesting. It's also a fluid situation, Josh. Market's not done. We'll see what happens over the next couple of days.
Gold fell. The US dollar rose. VIX fell 8% yesterday. VIX fell 8% yesterday. NASDAQ higher than where it was before this started. S&P rallying, Dow rallying.
I don't even know what the market is reacting to at this point. Like, market is rallying on what, honestly? A deteriorating economy?
I'll tell you what it's not reacting to. Geopolitics. It's not.
It's not responding to a slower economy. Like, we got retail sales this morning, not great. It's not responding to that. It's not responding to a deteriorating labor market. I don't know what it's responding to other than AI.
So the Fed meeting is tomorrow. That would normally be like one of the things over the course of the summer that the market reacts to.
Because they're not cutting.
The market doesn't think they're cutting. Steve Leisman was saying today on Halftime Report, the Fed's posture now is they're watching inflation, they're watching unemployment, and whichever one gets worse first is the one they'll worry about. So, like, that's the posture of the Fed this summer is on a chaise lounge.
Tim Araos just wrote a similar article. Obviously, he's the unofficial mouthpiece for the Fed in terms of the media, and he said the same thing. Like, they're not doing anything, chilling.
Okay, so stocks have fully discounted the opening stages of World War III, which I guess is bullish. Bank of America Global Fund Manager Survey is now back to pre-Liberation Day. Let me read this to you as Wall Street Journal. Investors' mood has rebounded back to the more bullish levels seen just before Liberation Day tariff salvo. Remember what that was like back then? February, March?
Not great. Yeah.
Right before. Everything was all systems go.
Yeah.
The bank's global fund manager survey found that fears of a global trade war and tariff-induced recession were receding. The proportion of surveyed investors expecting weaker global growth fell to a net 46%. You know where it was in April?
Wild.
82%.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Myself and Clem in that 82. Investors are now holding less cash today than they were in April, and are underweight the dollar, the highest level since 2005. A majority of respondents say international stocks will be the top performing asset over the next 5 years. Less than 25% say that U.S. stocks will keep dominating returns. So the contrarian trade amongst global fund managers is Mag7/S&P 500. That's interesting. The consensus is international stocks will be better over the next 5 years. What do you think?
I've never been more confused by sentiment and how to read and register what the investor is doing, because there is no the investor. The investor at Schwab is different than the investor at Robinhood, is different than the Global Fund Manager Survey. I was talking about this with Ben today. Schwab has a proprietary indicator called Stacks, where they are measuring the mood of the investor, and they are looking at flows, actual dollars. What are people doing? And the investor at Schwab, for the last 4 months, information technology has been the largest net sell sector. So go explain that one. I just don't know how to explain the investor these days, because which investor are you talking about?
So that's the retail investor at Schwab, or is that the advisor?
It's the retail investor at Schwab. Have been, okay. NVIDIA was the single largest net sale that they made in the month of April, or was it May? In the month of May.
The only way to explain
But it had been. It wasn't just that they loaded up at the bottom and then let go.
I was going to say the only way to explain that is it's just people selling what they have gains in so they could reallocate and buy something else.
It's more than that. It's 4 months in a row. So they were selling into the puke, whereas other investors were running into the building. Sentiment survey stuff is more noisy than ever.
Yeah. I think that's actually the best take. If you read a data point about, like, quote unquote, what the investor is doing, and it's coming from any one particular platform,
yes,
it doesn't always equate to like what they're doing across the board.
You could credibly make any argument for what the investor is doing. It's like in Civil War. Well, what type of American are you? Like that's how I feel. Like what type of investor, what type of survey did you respond to?
Right. When did you respond? What date did you respond? What was the market doing on the day you responded? What's the average demographic?
It's so noisy. Unless you're talking about extremes that all line up like they did in the sell-off. They really did. Everybody was bearish.
Like what's absent the median that, age? What's the median, not what's the median age individual investor at Schwab? What's the median age individual investor who would respond to a survey?
Yeah.
68.
So for the Schwab thing, it was proprietary insights into behavior, not sentiment stuff. So not that survey. I value.
Okay.
Don't tell me how you feel. Literally show me what you're doing. Because if you're bearish and buying, I don't care.
Yeah. You know who's been super active lately? Congressional stock traders.
Ooh, I don't like this. That's a great segue, Josh. So the Wall Street Journal wrote an article. Throw this up. This is disgusting. For people that are listening, it's the trades reported by House lawmakers or their families and a spike in April. Go f-ing figure. Here's the journal. From April 2nd, when Trump launched the sweeping tariffs, to April 8th, the day before they paused many of them, more than a dozen House lawmakers and their family members made more than 700 stock trades, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of disclosure filings. Let me ask you this. I have somebody that I know who works at a bank, somebody I know that works at a hedge fund, and one of them is only allowed to buy ETFs. They have to hold it for a minimum of a year. And I think it's the same thing at the bank as well. How come the restrictions on banks, on bank employees are so tight, but these people literally controlling policy are allowed to fucking trade on inside information? Who thinks this is a good idea?
I love
Stop.
It.
Stop.
I've come full circle on this issue. I think it's terrific.
All right. Let's hear it.
Let me ask you a question. Do you know what the salary is that they pay these people?
So pay them more.
Nah, let them earn it out. I like it. I think it's great. I really think it's great. Listen, this has been going on since time immemorial.
End it.
The Roman Senate was doing that. Do you know the richest
Dude, I have no time for market for history right now. You give a history lesson every episode.
I'll give you a quick one. This is important. The richest man in Rome, Crassus. No. It's important. He had his own fire department. And people would run and give him tips like, yo, there's a fire just broke out in like the slave quarter or whatever, like a fire just broke out at this merchant's store. His fire department would like race over there to the scene and he would arrive with them and he would say to the guy that owns the building, all right, this is how much it's going to cost you to for me to put out the fire. The guy would be like, I'm not paying you that. All right, no problem. You'll pay it to me in 5 minutes. 5 minutes goes by. The guy would be like, all right, fine, I'll pay you. He goes, oh, I'm sorry. The price just went up. This is what it is.
You
think these people are Girl Scouts?
Listen, also in the Colosseum back in Rome, circa whenever, they had gladiators fighting sharks with laser beams attached.
No,
I don't give a shit. This is ridiculous.
I'm just telling you, it's never going to change.
It will change.
People in a position of power.
It'll change.
When?
I don't know.
When? It will never change.
Okay,
People in a position of power will exploit that power.
StockTwits tweeted, in January, Nancy Pelosi with a hat tip to QuiverQuant. Nancy Pelosi bought up 10 call options. It's now up 133% since the trade. Why the f*** is Nancy – forgive me for all the F-bombs. Why is Nancy Pelosi allowed to buy call options?
Wait, what is TEM? She's buying tickers I've never heard of?
What's that you're breaking up? I don't know what TEM is.
Come on. You have no idea what that stock is?
It's not a stock. Listen, there's a lot of stocks. I don't follow all of them.
Please, I need to know. Tempest AI? What the hell is that?
Okay, so say, like, why? Why are we accepting this?
Why is she buying call options?
And maybe it's her advisor, wink, wink, doing it. I don't give a shit. Why is this allowed?
It's great. I love it.
No, it's horrendous.
Oh, is there anything more American than that? Come on. Listen, all I'm saying is, don't we want a society where everyone strives to be a multi-millionaire?
No. I know you're sticking out. This is not good for us. It's a clown show. And this has nothing to do with the current administration. It's always been this way. It's just enough already.
Tempus AI is an American health technology company founded in 2015 by Eric Lefkofsky in Chicago, Illinois. All right,
Is the Illinois part necessary? All right, let's move on. What's Johnson doing in Europe? See in the Colosseum?
Here's how I want to frame this. Is NVIDIA still the most important stock in the market?
Yeah, right now. I think so.
You agree?
Yeah. What
it goes through these periods of time where people just forget about it. The stock is up 50% from its April low or something. The stock has just like recovered literally everything that it lost.
Bought the low.
What's that?
Bought the low.
All right. So Jensen Huang made a run through Europe. He is a rock star in Europe. And my take is he is being seen very differently versus previous waves of U.S. technology. All right. So the Europeans like have always treated people like Mark Zuckerberg with a ton of suspicion. They've sued him. They've tried to get Facebook ejected from their countries. They've created new laws just to screw with different things that Meta owns, like WhatsApp, et cetera. Jensen is not getting that treatment. He's sitting with Macron, the president of France, at technology conferences. He's being very well received in UK, Prime Minister Keir Starmer. He's got rock star energy in London and Paris, everywhere he goes. And he's really bright. He's pitching this thing called sovereign AI, which I think is going to be like a new investing trend as we see some of these defense tech companies like Anduril start to come public. And we start to see more and more of what Palantir is selling all over the world.
What's sovereign AI?
Sovereign AI is this idea that every country should not only own its own data, but utilize it to bring about a safer security situation, a more equitable society. Just like, look, these countries are collecting enormous data sets, bigger than most individual companies. If companies are making this investment into utilizing their data to bring about higher profits, better outcomes for stakeholders, better work-life balance for employees, like why would individual companies be doing that and countries not? Also, if you believe this is the AI age and everyone's going to be empowered with all these tools, shouldn't the government utilize what exists out there to do a better job at being the government of a country? And then lastly, like as a way to preserve the culture, each country should have its own culture and the AI should reflect that country's culture. The whole world shouldn't just be operating on these homogenized data sets. So that's the pitch that Jensen Huang has been making as he attends all these events all summer. He was at this thing called the Viva Tech conference in Paris. Here's what he said. We believe that in order to compete, in order to build a more meaningful ecosystem, Europe needs to come together and build capacity that is joint. Then he talked about Wang spoke a lot during the week about sovereign AI, the concept of building data centers within a country's borders that services its population rather than relying on servers located overseas. European policymakers said that this was a very important topic. I don't know. It's a whole thing. I just think it's interesting to watch the rest of the world wake up to the need to not sit this one out the way that they did during the internet 1.0, the internet 2.0. Like they never, these countries never made big investments. They were super skeptical of the cloud, e-commerce, internet advertising. They kind of let the United States run away with it. And it doesn't look like they're going to continue to do that. Thoughts?
I was listening to Bill Simmons this morning bemoan the face of the league argument, which is funny because, and I'm a huge Bill Simmons fan, but that's sort of his thing. Like he's a big face of the league guy and now he doesn't like it. Whatever. My point is, I think NVIDIA is the face of the market right now. And I think it probably has been for 2 years. Do you agree with that? Like who would you think is the face in the market? It's not Apple anymore.
No.
It's not Meta. It's either Microsoft or NVIDIA. And it's got to be NVIDIA.
No, it's not Microsoft. It's NVIDIA. NVIDIA, all right, the S&P 500 is up 2.17% year to date. NVIDIA is 0.58 percentage points of that. So in other words, NVIDIA is 26% of the total return of the S&P. Okay? Put this chart up. 1 year NVIDIA price performance. Look at this rebound off the lows. It got down to under $100 and now it's 144.
So that's but it is interesting that we're talking about NVIDIA with glowing praise as it's earned. The stock's gone nowhere for the past year. And it's just gotten cheaper because the revenue and the earnings have just gone straight up.
It's gone nowhere. Some would say it's digested.
It's actually beautiful.
Huge multiple that's now become a smaller multiple.
Yeah. Listen, if you are a long-term shareholder, you would much prefer to see sideways than straight up and up forever.
I agree with that, because if it does a vertical move, you just know it's like only a matter of time.
You're on borrowed time. We'll give it back.
NVIDIA will contribute 17% of the total earnings growth being expected for the S&P 500 in calendar 2025.
Is that a record? I'd be curious to say. It's got to be, no?
It has to be. Not of the total earnings. This is important.
Of the earnings growth.
Of the earnings growth.
It's got to be.
Less insane. Drastic, but still drastic, right? Like, in other words, do you think the S&P 500 will make its number this year? I don't know, but if NVIDIA doesn't, then it won't. How many companies in history have you been able to say that about? Like on the growth side. One more. Here's the chips. This is the SMH, the VanEck Semiconductor ETF, total return.
So what do you see? What do you see, Sammy?
Well, dude, all the talk this spring has been about software.
What do you see?
And this is going to make it, this looks like it wants to take out the February high.
I mean, look at that. If NVIDIA, by the way. A cool runnings reference. That's a deep cut.
It wasn't bad.
That V rally is wild.
The SMH is up 47% from its April 8th low. 100% of the S&P semiconductor ETF components, the individual companies, are above their 50 days, and 71% are above their 200 days. So 70% of the holdings in the semi index are in their own individual bull markets. And now I want to show you.
Well, can I better one, do you? Listen to this. Micron. Have you seen that chart in a while? Mm-hmm. Micron was at $60 at the lows. Mm-hmm. I don't know, a whole 60 days ago. It's now at 120. It's doubled in 2 months.
Broadcom might be one of the best. That's might be one of the best performing stocks I've ever seen. The run that Broadcom is on is just legendary.
Broadcom AVGO looks sick. Even AMD.
AMD rallied 10%.
Let's check on Intel.
No, let's not do that. So everyone's been talking about software though. So software stocks did not have the dip that the semis had. And the chatter was, all right, the way to play AI used to be the semis, but that's over, and now it's going to be in the software layer. That's where all the money's going to get made.
Where?
Like the Workdays, the ServiceNows, the Salesforces, like those stocks held
Salesforce
the market
looks like
up.
Shit, but ServiceNow looks great.
Put up the 1 year total return. This is the semis versus the software ETF, IGV.
Wow. Narrative violator.
Yep. So software is in way better shape, taking the chart back a year, but the semis are coming back in a much more. Look at how the software sector never even went negative this April on a year over year basis versus how badly the semis got hit.
Yeah, interesting. I would
not
have
guessed
that.
These stocks, like CrowdStrike's in there. CrowdStrike, by the way, about to break 500.
Yeah.
That's a big component in that index now. You got your Palo Alto Networks in there. You got I'm not sure if Oracle's in there. Oracle's one of the best stocks of the year. So the software space has been better, but these semis are not asleep anymore. Like they're coming back.
Can I say something to you? I looked at this chart yesterday and I don't really want to buy it because there's so many other things that are working. But there's no more sellers of Intel. Like, look at the chart. Pull it up right now. No, seriously, pull up the chart.
I'm looking at it.
It has been at 18, between 18 and 21 bucks since August of 2024. Anytime it gets to 18, like, if you hadn't sold it at this point, I think this baby might be about to scream. I actually might buy it.
Look,
You see what I'm saying?
It absolutely could. The problem for me is I have to understand the story. And It's not necessary for all investors. I'm saying for me.
I understand.
I have to understand. So let me give you an example. Amazon had this huge PR blitz today. And we're not going to spend a ton of time on Amazon because we're going to do that later. But like they have this laboratory in Texas called Annapurna, which is where they make their own chips. And the thing that they were doing this big PR blitz about was their new CPU chip. That is directly impinging on Intel's business. Intel is a CPU chip company. And the silicon that Amazon is now producing itself, creating and producing itself, it's like one more example of Intel's former customers just making their own custom shit. And in that landscape, I need to understand why all of a sudden people aren't going to care about that.
Okay. I hear you and you're probably right. Here's what I understand. There is a big juicy gap all the way up at $29. And I might, like Bill Pullman said in Independence Day, I might want another shot at it.
Okay. I'd also say though, it's been cheap the whole way down. And
I don't care about cheap. I'm just saying there's no more sellers. That's all. They are gone.
I mean, it's Nike, it's Pfizer, it's like it's a group of these stocks that just, they're just, the narrative is so against it.
Exactly. And the stock isn't going down anymore.
No, but they keep going. Some of them keep going, some of them don't. You don't know which is which. I don't know which is which.
I can just say that definitively Intel has stopped going down for a year.
All right. Here's where we could agree and then we'll move on. I don't want to short it. I don't want to short anything, but I definitely don't want to be short that. Yeah.
Okay, what are we moving on to? Oh, okay.
Rates.
So you and I got into a disagreement last year. You were of the opinion that banks were going to have to raise their rates to be competitive. And I said, no, people, it's just, they know how we behave and we don't move our money.
Great call.
Look at this chart from Torsten Slack. Truly wild. What we're looking at for the listeners is the interest rate on checking accounts versus the Fed funds rate. And that entire time, I mean, I thought it would move a little bit, like did not lift off the ground.
So you, like if I were right, the savings account is the blue line.
Yeah.
You would have seen the rate on a savings account get off zero.
Get off zero.
And trend toward like, let's say 1% even. And it's not.
All right. So here's another face blower melter for you, Josh. Also from Torsten Slack.
Wait. Is the implication of this that we're now at a point in society where we don't rely on our banks for anything other than safety and continuity, and we don't think of banks as a place to have our money make money? Because that's reasonable. Another way that I want you to think about this is all the major banks that are probably over-indexed in that review, they have wealth management operations. And maybe instead of the banks having to raise the deposit rate, they have successfully convinced the clients, no, we're not going to do that. But the money that you want to have invested, move it over to our wealth management business. Wells Fargo, Bank of America owns Merrill. JP Morgan has two different brokerage firms plus a whole private wealth thing.
I think that's a component of it. But the reality is most people just don't have a lot of money in their checking account or their savings account. And even if it's not an insignificant amount, like even if it's like 30 grand, like it just stays. It just doesn't move.
So if you had 100 grand at Bank of America and you call them up and said, why aren't I making any money? I really think that Bank of America would say, you have 100 grand sitting in your bank account. What you should do is take 50 of that and move it over into your brokerage account.
For sure.
And we'll put a consultant on the phone with you who will sell you a T-bill fund or something. Like I think that's functionally what's going on with high balance.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt. Those people are getting called. They're getting a call for sure. Here's another one. 21% of deposits. Now, again, these are probably tiny chunks, right? I'm guessing these are like small dollar amounts, but nevertheless, 21%. It's not an insignificant amount of money. 21% of deposits pay no interest. No interest.
Wild. Yeah, Mike, I'm telling you, I think people now are looking at the bank account as only safety and functionality and not as a way to generate income or wealth or anything. And they're fine with it. Like they have other outlets to do
they're
that.
Great. All right, here's a sort of a non sequitur, but I didn't know where to put this and I just wanted to talk to you about it quickly. This is another monster narrative violator. We're looking from Bank of America Global Investment Strategy. The foreign inflow to U.S. stocks year to date is annualizing for the second largest year ever. Okay, excuse me. I was told that foreigners are no longer interested in our markets, our dollars, our markets, our stocks, our bonds.
It's early, bro.
Dude, stop.
Where's all that capital flight? Where is it?
It's the second largest ever.
When is all that capital flight start?
So just pump the brakes.
I was told that foreign investors were angry at Donald Trump and tariffs, and they were losing faith in the United States Treasury simultaneously because of our high debt levels.
And they're buying the renminbi.
We're going to repatriate to renminbi.
Yeah. Yeah. Not happening. Not happening.
It's early. I maintain it's early. All right. We'll do this one quickly. Another journal story today talked about the growing rift between OpenAI and Microsoft. And I'm not sure how much to make of this. Here's why it's important for investors, because we're not a tech. We don't do like a tech podcast. Microsoft owns 49% of OpenAI. OpenAI is going to be, if not the most important, it will be among the top three most important AI companies in the world for the foreseeable future. It'd be really hard for me to hear somebody make the case for why it won't be important a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. Like, I think by the end of the decade, this will still be one of the most important players in arguably the biggest technology revolution since the internet. OpenAI has incredible metrics any way you look at it. The partnership with Microsoft has obviously played a big role in that. But Microsoft has its own AI ambitions away from OpenAI. And one of the problems now here is that OpenAI is trying to make this conversion from a not-for-profit with a profit-driven arm to a full-on for-profit standalone company. And that transition is necessary in order for them to raise the money that they're supposed to be raising from SoftBank. So there's like $20 billion of capital on the line. They have till the end of this year to fully convert to a for-profit to get their hands on that $20 billion. And every billion dollars counts in this race to build out, you know, these platforms. So basically, this rift kind of exploded into public view over an acquisition that OpenAI is making. They're buying this, I forget what it's called, Win something or other. They're buying this thing for $3 billion and it's got this proprietary data, and OpenAI does not want to share the data that's going to come with this acquisition with Microsoft. Microsoft sees itself as the parent company and exclusive partner of OpenAI on ChatGPT. And OpenAI sees Microsoft as a 49% shareholder who needs to back off and leave us alone. So it's a really interesting moment. And I think the longer that tension persists, the better it will be for other competitors like Amazon's Anthropic, for example, that are trying to gain a foothold here. That kind of distraction could be meaningful in the stock market. One other thing I wanted to just show you. One other thing I wanted to just mention here that I think is important. People need to understand how big OpenAI is going to be. I don't know when it's going to go public. It could be the biggest IPO in history.
Why does it need to go public? Microsoft's not looking for liquidity.
It has to go public because it has to raise money. They're talking about $1 trillion buildouts. So for AI, period. Like it has to have the ability to raise its own money, okay? This is what we're talking about here, okay? OpenAI revenue growth as of June, annualized run rate of $10 billion. That's double the annualized run rate reported in December, $5.5 billion.
It better be doubling.
Okay, I'm just saying its annualized run rate has doubled in 6 months. The company is projecting $12.7 billion in revenue for 2025. That would be an 82% year-over-year growth rate. As far as user growth, ChatGPT has 500 million weekly active users. Do you have any idea how big that is? Okay. Between December of 2024 and March of 25, active users grew 33%. So rising from 375 million to 500 million. So this is a company that is sitting on the biggest user base, AI user base on the planet. It's not even currently set up as a for-profit company. It is struggling to make that conversion, fighting against its largest shareholder, which is the second largest publicly traded company in the world, Microsoft. This is a really fascinating situation, and the implications for all of the other tech giants that are trying to compete in AI, I think, are massive, like how this shakes out and what ends up happening. So I wanted to put that on everyone's radar. Any thoughts?
It is. Did you say it's going to be the biggest IPO ever?
Well, the only thing on the runway that potentially could be bigger is maybe SpaceX.
What is the biggest IPO ever?
I think at its time or in
today's
dollars.
Well, it used to be Facebook, right? Or was Facebook even? I don't even remember. Alibaba?
I think Alibaba in its moment.
Yeah.
Was,
all right, anyway.
Will be the biggest period.
Yeah.
If this came public a year from now, which is conceivable, this will be bigger than anything that's ever come public.
So I think the last valuation was $300 billion. It could come public bigger than Berkshire. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's conceivable because the thing that would hold it back from that is if we look at the expense side and we decide, okay, that's so much growth, that's great, but like you'll never make money.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what's going to happen though.
Is there any even whispers of when an IPO would be? Probably not anytime soon.
It can't even talk about it because they're currently not even set up.
Okay.
As the type, the structure of a company that could be public. It's like, that's how early they still are.
Yeah.
In their, it's a wild situation to have something like this 50% held by Microsoft. And then the question is, how much of the growth and the valuation expectations for OpenAI are baked into the Microsoft valuation?
Right. Yeah, a lot of moving parts.
How much do Microsoft investors expect them to get, A, from the partnership, and B, from the eventual share sales that might become possible?
Right.
You know, what percentage would Microsoft sell in a public offering? Half their holdings? Could this thing get to a valuation that's so big that like there's just no buyers for it?
And what is 13 times 47?
Yeah. All right.
Okay, you're gonna make the case, or am I doing Mr. Richard? What do you do first? I can't remember.
I'm gonna make the case. Okay. Amazon's going to 250. It's 217 today ish, I think. Let me show you a chart. I love this. I love these types of charts. So very straightforward Y charts. I'm showing you volume and RSI in the bottom pane. I'm showing you the gap higher after their earnings in late April or early May. And what you can see is that after this huge upside gap, not huge, but big upside gap, a very low volume retest of, is that the 200 day?
This is a FAMI special.
Yeah. So look at this low volume retest that I have in the top oval of that 200 day, gets below it for 10 minutes, springs right up off of it, and is now poised for the next higher high. And RSI, so relative strength, during that little dip back to the 200 day, held up perfectly.
Yeah.
So we're not overbought. We're about a 64, 65 RSI. You had the retest already, and now I think you could be off to the races. Amazon, from my perspective, has the ability to be the best performing name in the Mag 7. The mean analyst target right now, 44 firms covering the stock, is in the 240s. So I'm saying 250. The way I want you to think about this, Michael, it's the stock's 217. It's like a $21 stock going to 25. So I'm not saying like something crazy is about to happen, but the Tranium chips we talked about, competing with Blackwell, it's not that they're competing at the cutting edge of tech. It's that they're competing at the power per dollar spent. It's a much more efficient chip, the new Tranium chip, than what's out there in the market. I'm saying that AWS, Amazon's cloud unit, is the most important AI infrastructure company in the world. I'm also saying the market cap could be worth $3 trillion. AWS is a standalone business. If you remove this from the grocery store, this could be like a $3 trillion company, AWS. The entire market cap of Amazon right now is only $2.3 trillion. AWS has more cloud share globally than Azure and Google Cloud, its two biggest competitors combined. AWS has 29% of the global cloud market and growing. This is, in my opinion, the fat pitch amongst the Mag 7. And here, let me show you one more chart. Okay, this is fascinating. This is Amazon stock price versus forward earnings estimates for the current fiscal year in blue and forward estimates for next fiscal year in orange. And it just continually updates, right? Look at the stair step pattern in this earnings growth off the bottom in July of 2022. So for the last 3 years, the current year estimates just move up and to the right, up and to the right in a stair step pattern. That's the blue. And in the orange, the next fiscal year's earnings estimates, which are now at $7.36. And you can see
that dip is all CapEx.
100%. So I'm just going to tell you, I think the earnings here, like ultimately by the end of this AI build out, could be $10 worth of earnings. This stock ain't staying at 200. It's just not.
Amazon is, I believe, my second largest holding. So I'm in with you.
35 times PE ratio, 29 forward.
Whatever.
17% expected earnings growth next year.
That's what I'm talking about.
I mean,
did you know that over the last 5 years, despite of or in spite of, I don't know, all of this growth, Amazon is up 65%. The S&P is up 106%.
Yeah.
So it's been smoked.
Look, they had a horrific post-pandemic period. Their earnings effectively collapsed. They did so much hiring and building and spending, but it wasn't a waste.
They messed up. Yep, they fixed it.
They messed up, but a lot of that infrastructure spend is now converting to profit.
Well, it's got to gush.
They were earning in 2020, in the pandemic year, they were earning $21 billion. In the last 12 months, they've earned $66 billion. Their earnings power has tripled over the last 5 years. Do you understand? Nobody, because I think, honestly think people are underestimating what's happening at Amazon.
You and I are not. You're long.
All right.
You got and Svelte, right? You're long and Svelte?
Yeah. Okay. Let's solve it.
Okay. This is a company that, and it's also a stock. How about that? You mentioned it on the show. Mm. This is year to date, and it has springboarded off of the lows from 120, holy mackerel, from 120 to 211. John, if you'd please zoom out a little bit.
I said the name of the stock today.
You did. It's actually underperformed big league until... Adorable. Yes, and then one more zoom out. So this was the last clip. Look at this beast. So Oracle was, and good guess, Josh.
Holy
credit to you.
Shit, thank you.
So Oracle was written up in Barron's over the weekend.
Good timing.
They said Oracle will be the number one cloud database company. Oracle will be the number one cloud applications company. And Oracle will be the number one builder and operator of cloud infrastructure. So that's exactly where you want to be.
They relate to the cloud, but they have more than made up for it.
The headline was capital spending for the fourth quarter was $9.1 billion, or nearly 60% of overall revenue. And this is how shareholders are treating the stock. They don't care. In fact, they love it.
Do you know who the CEO of Oracle is?
I just mentioned his name. I don't know. It doesn't ring a bell.
Safra Katz.
Who is that?
It's a woman.
What do you mean? I said it was a man. I said, who is that?
I'm saying
okay.
Nobody who's casually follows tech knows who she is. Tech people know who she is. Larry Ellison looms so large over this company still. Obviously, the largest shareholder, and he's like 80 years old.
He looks great.
Oh, this guy. He's like, if you were writing a book about who are the people who have won the most in life, he's definitely like top 100 in history.
Big
this guy is just. I mean, he owns his own like Hawaiian islands. He does whatever he wants. His son's like, Dad, I want to run an entertainment conglomerate. Oh, okay, no problem. I'll just buy you Paramount. What else should we do today? You want to have lunch? Like this guy is Sizola. And look at the stock. He deserves it. If you're a shareholder in Oracle, you're not a Mag 7, but so what? Like you're doing as well as shareholder in any other stock that you could think of. This thing is just on fire. All right, okay. That's it from us today. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate those of you who attend the live premiere, of course. I want to mention that tomorrow is Wednesday, which means an all-new edition of my favorite podcast, Animal Spirits with Michael and Ben.
Tomorrow was a good one.
Yep. By the way, guys, the merch store is open this summer, and it's idontshop.com. Look at this shit that we're... Dude, the towel is insane.
Mm.
Look at that towel. You want to rock one of those at Catalina, right?
I need.
All right. Nicole, get Michael and I towels, please. New Animal Spirits t-shirt and the all-new Series 777. That's so hot, that shirt. Available in two colorways. Check out idontshop.com to see all of our Compound merchandise. Shout out to the whole team. And guys, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Whether you're just getting started as an investor or you're managing a multi-million dollar portfolio, Ritholtz Wealth Management has the solution for you. It all starts with building the right financial plan. To speak with a certified financial planner today, visit RitholtzWealth.com. Don't forget to check us out at YouTube.com/TheCompoundRWM. Make sure to leave a rating and review on your favorite podcasting app. If you love investing podcasts, check out Michael and Ben every Wednesday morning on Animal Spirits. Thanks for listening.